stranger that he is to them. They are ashamed of this enmity. Yet, if the grandmother maintains her warm affection for her grandchildren while giving up the idea of entirely possessing them, she can play the privileged role of guardian angel in their lives. Recognizing neither rights nor responsibilities, she loves them out of pure generosity. She does not entertain narcissistic dreams through them. She asks nothing of them. She does not sacrifice their future in which she will not be present. What she loves are the little flesh and blood beings who are there today in their contingency and their gratuitousness. She is not an educator. She does not represent abstract justice or law. This is where the conflicts that at times set her in opposition to the parents will sometimes arise. It may be that the woman has no descendants or is not interested in posterity. Lacking natural bonds with children or grandchildren, she sometimes tries to create them artificially with counterparts. She offers maternal tenderness to young people. Whether or not her affection remains platonic, it is not necessarily hypocrisy that makes her declare that she loves her young protege like a son. The mother's feelings, inversely, are love feelings. It is true that Madame de Warance's competitors take pleasure in generously satisfying, helping, and shaping a man. They want to be the source, the necessary condition, and the foundation of an existence that has passed them by. They become mothers and find their identity in their lovers far more in this role than in the role of mistress. Very often, also the maternal woman adopts girls. Here again, their relations take more or less sexual forms, but whether platonic or carnal, what she seeks in her protégés is her own double, miraculously rejuvenated. The actress, the dancer, the singer become teachers, they form pupils, and the intellectual woman, such as Madame de Charrière, alone in Colombier, indoctrinates disciples. The devotee gathers spiritual daughters around her. The seductress becomes a madam. It is never pure self-interest that brings such ardent zeal to their proselytizing. They are passionately seeking to reincarnate themselves. Their tyrannical generosity gives rise to more or less the same conflicts as between mothers and daughters, united by blood. It is also possible to adopt grandchildren. Great aunts and godmothers gladly play a role similar to that of grandmothers. But in any case, it is rare for a woman to find in posterity, natural or selected, a justification of her declining life. She fails to make the enterprise of these young existences her own. Either she persists in the effort to appropriate it, consumed in the struggles and dramas that leave her disappointed and broken, or she resigns herself to a modest participation. This is the most common case. The aged mother and grandmother repress their dominating desires. They conceal their resentments. They are satisfied with whatever their children choose to give them. But then they get little help from them. They remain available facing the desert of the future, prey to solitude, regret, and ennui. Here we touch upon the older woman's tragedy. She realizes she is useless. All through her life, the bourgeois woman often has to resolve the derisory problem, how to kill time. For once the children are raised and the husband has become successful, or at least settled, days drag on. Women's handiwork was invented to mask this horrible idleness. Hands embroider, knit, they are busy hands, and they move. It is not a question here of real work because the object produced is not the goal. It has little importance, and it is often a problem to know what to do with it. One gets rid of it by giving it to a friend or a charitable organization, or by cluttering mantelpieces or coffee tables. Neither is it a game that reveals the pure joy of existence in its gratuitousness. And it is hardly a diversion because the mind is vacant. It is an absurd distraction, as Pascal described it. With needle or hook, woman sadly weaves the very nothingness of her days. Watercolors, music, or reading have the very same role. The unoccupied woman does not try to extend her grasp on the world in giving herself over to such activities, but only to relieve boredom. An activity that does not open up the future slides into the vanity of imminence. The idle woman begins a book, then puts it down, opens the piano, closes it, returns to her embroidery, yawns, and ends up on the telephone. In fact, she is more likely to seek relief in social life. She goes out, makes visits, and, like Mrs. Dalloway, attaches enormous importance to her parties. She goes to every wedding, every funeral. No longer having any existence of her own, she feeds on the company of others. She goes from being a coquette to a gossip. She watches, she comments. She compensates for her inaction by dispensing criticism and advice to those around her. She gives her experienced advice even to those around her who do not seek it. If she has the means, she holds a salon. In this way, she hopes to appropriate undertakings and successes that are not hers. Madame de Defense and Madame Verdurin's despotism over their subjects is well known. To be a center of attraction, a crossroads, an inspiration, or to create an atmosphere is in itself an ersatz activity. There are other, more direct ways to intervene in the course of the world. In France, there are charities and a few clubs, but it is particularly true in America that women group together in clubs where they play bridge, hand out literary prizes, or reflect on social improvement. What characterizes most of these organizations on the two continents is that they are in themselves their own reason for existence. The aims they claim to pursue serve only as a pretext. Things happen exactly as in Kafka's fable. No one is concerned about building the Tower of Babel. A vast city is built around its ideal place, consuming all its resources for administration, growth, and resolving internal dissensions. Note, the city coat of arms. So charity women spend most of their time organizing their organization. They elect a board, discuss its statutes, dispute among themselves, and struggle to keep their prestige over rival associations. No one must steal their poor, their sick, their wounded, their orphans. They would rather leave them to die than yield them to their neighbors. And they are far from wanting a regime that, in doing away with injustice and abuse, would make their dedication useless. They bless the wars and famines that transform them into benefactresses of humanity. It is clear that in their eyes, the knit hats and parcels are not intended for soldiers and the hungry. Instead, the soldiers and the hungry are made expressly to receive knit goods and parcels. In spite of everything, some of these groups attain positive results. In the United States, the influence of venerated moms is strong. This is explained by the leisure time their parasitic existence leaves them, and this is why it is harmful. Knowing nothing about medicine, art, science, religion, law, sanitation, says Philip Wiley, speaking of the American mom, she seldom has any especial interest in what, exactly, she is doing as a member of any of these endless organizations, so long as it is something. Note, generation of vipers. Their effort is not integrated into a coherent and constructive plan. It does not aim at objective ends. Imperiously, it tends only to show their tastes and prejudices or to serve their interests. They play a considerable role in the domain of culture, for example. It is they who buy the most books, but they read as one plays the game of solitaire. Literature takes its meaning and dignity when it is addressed to individuals committed to projects, when it helps them surpass themselves toward greater horizons. It must be integrated into the movement of human transcendence. Instead, woman devalues books and works of art by swallowing them into her immanence. A painting becomes a knick-knack, music an old song, a novel a reverie as useless as crocheted antimacassars. It is American women who are responsible for the degradation of bestsellers. These books are only intended to please, and worse, to please idle women who need escape. As for their activities in general, Philip Wiley defines them like this. They frighten politicians to sniveling servility, and they terrify pastors. They bother bank presidents, and they pulverize school boards. Mom has many such organizations, the real purpose of which is to compel an abject compliance of her environs to her personal desires. She drives out of the town and the state, if possible, all young harlots. She causes bus lines to run where they are convenient for her rather than for workers, throws prodigious fairs and parties for charity, and gives the proceeds to the janitor to buy the committee some beer for its headache on the morning after. Clubs afford Mom an infinite opportunity for nosing into other people's business. There is much truth in this aggressive satire. Not being specialized in politics or economics or any technical discipline, old women have no concrete hold on society. They are unaware of the problems action poses. They are incapable of elaborating a constructive program. Their morality is abstract and formal, like Kant's imperatives. They issue prohibitions instead of trying to discover the paths of progress. They do not positively try to create new situations. They attack what already exists in order to do away with the evil in it. This explains why they are always forming coalitions against something, against alcohol, prostitution, or pornography. They do not understand that a purely negative effort is doomed to be unsuccessful, as evidenced by the failure of prohibition in America, or the law in France voted by Marta Richard. As long as woman remains a parasite, she cannot effectively participate in the building of a better world. It does happen that in spite of everything, some women entirely committed to a cause truly have an impact. These women are not merely seeking to keep themselves busy. They have ends in view. Autonomous producers, they escape from the parasitic category we are considering here. But this conversion is rare. In their private or public activities, most women do not aim for a goal that can be reached, but for a way to keep busy. And no occupation is meaningful if it is only a pastime. Many of them suffer from this. With a life already behind them, they feel the same distress as adolescent boys whose lives have not yet opened up. Nothing is calling them. Around them both is a desert. Faced with any action, they murmur, "What's the use?" But the adolescent boy is drawn, willingly or not, into a man's existence that reveals responsibilities, goals, and values. He is thrown into the world. He takes a stand. He becomes committed. If it is suggested to the older woman that she begin to move toward the future, she responds sadly, "It's too late." It is not that her time is limited from here on. A woman is made to retire very early, but she lacks the drive, confidence, hope, and anger that would allow her to discover new goals in her own life. She takes refuge in the routine that has always been her lot. She makes repetition her system. She throws herself into household obsessions. She becomes more deeply religious. She becomes rigidly stoic, like Madame de Charrière. She becomes brittle, indifferent, egotistical. The old woman often finds serenity toward the end of her life when she has given up the fight, when death's approach frees her from anxiety about the future. Her husband was often older than she. She witnesses his decline with silent complacency. It is her revenge. If he dies first, she cheerfully bears the mourning. It has often been observed that men are far more overwhelmed by being widowed late in life. They profit more from marriage than women do, and particularly in their old age, because then the universe is concentrated within the limits of the home. The present does not spill over into the future. It is their wife who assures their monotonous rhythm and reigns over them. When he loses his public functions, man becomes totally useless. Woman continues at least to run the home. She is necessary to her husband, whereas he is only a nuisance. Women are proud of their independence. They finally begin to view the world through their own eyes. They realize they have been duped and mystified their whole lives. Now lucid and wary, they often attain a delicious cynicism. In particular, the woman who has lived has a knowledge of men that no man shares, for she has seen not their public image, but the contingent individual that every one of them lets show in the absence of their counterparts. She also knows women who only show themselves in their spontaneity to other women. She knows what happens behind the scenes. But even if her experience allows her to denounce mystifications and lies, it is not enough to reveal the truth to her. Whether she is amused or bitter, the old woman's wisdom still remains completely negative. It is contestation, accusation, refusal. It is sterile. In her thoughts, as in her acts, the highest form of freedom a woman parasite can have is stoic defiance or skeptical irony. At no time in her life does she succeed in being both effective and independent. Chapter 10. Woman's Situation and Character. We can now understand why, from ancient Greece to today, there are so many common features in the indictments against woman. Her condition has remained the same throughout superficial changes, and this condition defines what is called the woman's character. She wallows in imminence. She is argumentative. She is cautious and petty. She does not have the sense either of truth or of accuracy. She lacks morality. She is vulgarly self-serving, selfish. She is a liar and an actress. There is some truth in all these affirmations, but the types of behaviors denounced are not dictated to woman by her hormones or predestined in her brain's compartments. They are suggested in negative form by her situation. We will attempt to take a synthetic point of view of her situation, necessarily leading to some repetition, but making it possible to grasp the eternal feminine in her economic, social, and historical conditioning as a whole. The feminine world is sometimes contrasted with the masculine universe, but it must be reiterated that women have never formed an autonomous and closed society. They are integrated into the group governed by males, where they occupy a subordinate position. They are united by a mechanical solidarity only insofar as they are similar. They do not share that organic solidarity upon which any unified community is founded. They have always endeavored, in the period of the Eleusinian mysteries, just like today in clubs, salons, and recreation rooms, to band together to assert a counter-universe, but it is still within the masculine universe that they frame it. And this is where the paradox of their situation comes in. They belong both to the male world and to a sphere in which this world is challenged. Enclosed in this sphere, involved in the male world, they cannot peacefully establish themselves anywhere. Their docility is always accompanied by refusal, their refusal by acceptance. This is similar to the girl's attitude, but it is more difficult to maintain because it is no longer simply a question of the adult woman dreaming her life through symbols, but of living it. The woman herself recognizes that the universe as a whole is masculine. It is men who have shaped it and ruled it, and who still today dominate it. As for her, she does not consider herself responsible for it. It is understood that she is inferior and dependent. She has not learned the lessons of violence. She has never emerged as a subject in front of other members of the group. Enclosed in her flesh, in her home, she grasps herself as passive, opposite to these human-faced gods who set goals and standards. In this sense, there is truth in the saying that condemns her to remaining an eternal child. It has also been said of workers, black slaves, and colonized natives that they were big children as long as they were not threatening. That meant they had to accept without argument the truths and laws that other men gave them. Woman's lot is obedience and respect. She has no grasp, even in thought, on this reality that involves her. It is an opaque presence in her eyes. That means she has not learned the technology that would enable her to dominate matter. As for her, she is not fighting with matter, but with life. And life cannot be mastered by tools. One can only submit to its secret laws. The world does not appear to the woman as a set of tools, halfway between her will and her goals, as Heidegger defines it. On the contrary, it is a stubborn, indomitable resistance. It is dominated by fate and run through with mysterious caprices. No mathematics can make an equation out of this mystery of a spot of blood that changes into a human being in the mother's womb. No machine can rush it or slow it down. She experiences the resistance of a duration that the most ingenious machines fail to divide or multiply. She experiences it in her flesh that is subjected to the rhythm of the moon, and that the years first ripen and then corrode. Daily cooking teaches her patience and passivity. It is alchemy. One must obey fire, water, wait for the sugar to melt, the dough to rise, and also the clothes to dry, the fruit to ripen. Housework comes close to a technical activity, but it is too rudimentary, too monotonous, to convince the woman of the laws of mechanical causality. Besides, even in this area, things are capricious. There is material that revives and material that does not revive in the wash, spots that come out and others that persist, objects that break on their own, dust that grows like plants. Woman's mentality perpetuates that of agricultural civilizations that worship the earth's magical qualities. She believes in magic. Her passive eroticism reveals her desire not as will and aggression, but as an attraction similar to that which makes the dowser's pendulum quiver. The mere presence of her flesh makes the male sex swell and rise. Why should hidden water not make the dowser's wand jump? She feels surrounded by waves, radiation, fluid. She believes in telepathy, astrology, divination, Mesmer's baquet, theosophy, table turning, mind readers, and healers. She introduces primitive superstitions into religion, candles, ex votos, and such. She embodies ancient spirits of nature and the saints. This one protects travelers, that one women who have just given birth, another one finds lost objects. And of course, no marvel surprises her. Her attitude will be that of conjuration and prayer. To obtain a certain result, she will follow certain time-tested rites. It is easy to understand why she is ruled by routine. Time has no dimension of novelty for her. It is not a creative spring. Because she is doomed to repetition, she does not see in the future anything but a duplication of the past. If one knows the word and the recipe, duration is allied with the powers of fecundity. But this, too, obeys the rhythm of months and seasons. The cycle of each pregnancy, of each flowering, reproduces the preceding one identically. In this circular movement, time's soul becoming is slow degradation. It eats at furniture and clothes just as it disfigures the face. Fertile powers are destroyed little by little by the flight of years. So the woman does not trust this force driven to destroy. Not only is she unaware of what real action is that is able to change the face of the world, but she is lost in the middle of this world, as in the heart of an immense and confused mass. She does not know how to use masculine logic well. Stendhal noted that she handles it as skillfully as man if she has to. But it is an instrument she does not often have the occasion to use. A syllogism is not useful in making mayonnaise or calming a child's tears. Masculine reasoning is not relevant to the reality she experiences. And in the man's world, since she does not do anything, her thinking, as it does not flow into any project, is no different from a dream. She does not have the sense of truth, because she lacks efficacy. She struggles only by means of images and words. That is why she accepts the most contradictory assertions without a problem. She does not care about clarifying the mysteries of a sphere, which in any case is beyond her scope. She settles for horribly vague knowledge when it concerns her. She confuses parties, opinions, places, people, and events. There is a strange jumble in her head. But after all, seeing clearly is not her business. She was taught to accept masculine authority. She thus foregoes criticizing, examining, and judging for herself. She leaves it to the superior caste. This is why the masculine world seems to be a transcendent reality, an absolute to her. Men make gods, says Fraser, and women worship them. Men cannot kneel with total conviction in front of idols they themselves have created, but when women come across these imposing statues on their path, they cannot imagine any hand making them, and they meekly bow down before them. Note, refer to J.P. Sartre, Les Mains Sales, Dirty Hands. Herderer, they need props, you understand. They are given ready-made ideas. Then they believe in them as they do in God. We're the ones who make these ideas, and we know how they are cooked up. We are never quite sure of being right. They specifically like law and order to be embodied in a chief. In all Olympus, there is one sovereign God. The prestigious, virile essence must be gathered in one archetype of which father, husband, and lovers are merely vague reflections. It is somewhat humorous to say that their worship of this great totem is sexual. What is true is that women fully realize their infantile dream of abdication and prostration. In France, the generals Boulanger, Pétain, and de Gaulle have always had the support of women. Note, on the generals' passage, the public was made up mostly of women and children, les journaux, about the September 1948 tour in Savoy. The men applauded the general's speech, but the women stood out by their enthusiasm. Some were literally in ecstasy, singling out almost every word and clapping and shouting with a fervor that made their faces turn poppy red. Aux Écoutes, April 11, 1947. One remembers the purple prose of L'Humanité's women journalists when writing about Tito and his beautiful uniform. The general or the dictator, eagle eye, prominent chin, is the celestial father the serious universe demands, the absolute guarantor of all values. The respect women grant to heroes and to the masculine world's laws stems from their powerlessness and ignorance. They acknowledge these laws not through judgment, but through an act of faith. Faith draws its fanatical power from the fact that it is not knowledge. It is blind, passionate, stubborn, and stupid. What it puts forward is done unconditionally, against reason, against history, against all refutation. This stubborn reverence can take two forms depending on circumstances. Sometimes it is the content of the law, and sometimes the empty form alone that the woman passionately abides by. If she belongs to the privileged elite that profits from the given social order, she wants it unshakable, and she is seen as intransigent. The man knows he can reconstruct other institutions, another ethics, another code. Grasping himself as transcendence, he also envisages history as a becoming. Even the most conservative knows that some change is inevitable, and that he has to adapt his action and thinking to it. As the woman does not participate in history, she does not understand its necessities. She mistrusts the future and wants to stop time. If the idols her father, brothers, and husband propose are knocked down, she cannot imagine any way of repopulating the heavens. She is determined to defend them. Among the Southerners during the Civil War, no one was as passionately in favor of slavery as the women. In England, during the Boer War, and in France against the Commune, it was the women who were the most enraged. They seek to compensate for their inaction by the force of the feelings they display. In victory, they are as wild as hyenas against the beaten enemy. In defeat, they bitterly refuse any arrangement. As their ideas are only attitudes, they do not mind defending the most outdated causes. They can be legitimists in 1914, Tsarists in 1949. Sometimes the man smilingly encourages them. It pleases him to see his measured opinions reflected in a fanatical form. But sometimes he is also bothered by the stupid and stubborn way his own ideas are transformed. It is only in strongly integrated civilizations and classes that the woman looks so intransigent. Generally, as her faith is blind, she respects the laws simply because they are laws. The laws may change, but they keep their prestige. In the eyes of women, power creates law, since the laws they recognize in men come from their power. That is why they are the first to throw themselves at the victor's feet when a group collapses. In general, they accept what is. One of their typical features is resignation. When the ashes of Pompeii's statues were dug out, it was observed that the men were caught in movements of revolt, defying the sky or trying to flee, while the women were bent, withdrawn into themselves, turning their faces toward the earth. They know they are powerless against things, volcanoes, policemen, employers, or men. Women are made to suffer, they say. That's life. Nothing can be done about it. This resignation engenders the patience often admired in women. They withstand physical suffering much better than men. They are capable of stoic courage when circumstances demand it. Without the aggressive daring of the male, many women are distinguished by the calm tenacity of their passive resistance. They deal with crises, misery, and misfortune more energetically than their husbands. Respectful of duration that no haste can conquer, they do not measure their time. When they apply their calm stubbornness to any undertaking, they are sometimes brilliantly successful. Whatever a woman wants, says the proverb. Note, French proverb. What woman wants, God wants. Translation. In a generous woman, resignation looks like indulgence. She accepts everything. She condemns no one because she thinks that neither people nor things can be different from what they are. A proud woman can make a lofty virtue of it, like Madame de Charrière, rigid in her stoicism. But she also engenders a sterile prudence. Women always try to keep, to fix, to arrange, rather than to destroy and reconstruct anew. They prefer compromises and exchanges to revolutions. In the 19th century, they constituted one of the biggest obstacles to the effort of women workers' emancipation. For every Flora Tristan or Louise Michel, how many utterly timid housewives begged their husbands not to take any risk. They were afraid not only of strikes, unemployment, and misery, they also feared that the revolt was a mistake. Submission for submission. It is understandable that they prefer routine to adventure. They eke out for themselves a more meager happiness at home than on the streets. Their lot is one with that of perishable things. They would lose everything in losing them. Only a free subject, asserting himself beyond time, can foil destruction. This supreme recourse is forbidden to the woman. It is mainly because she has never experienced the powers of liberty that she does not believe in liberation. The world, to her, seems governed by an obscure destiny against which it is presumptuous to react. These dangerous paths that she is compelled to follow are ones she herself has not traced. It is understandable that she does not take them enthusiastically. Note, refer to Gide, Journal. Creusa or Lot's wife, one tarries and the other looks back, which is a worse way of tarrying. There is no greater cry of passion than this. And Phaedra, having braved the labyrinth with you, would have been found with you or lost with you. But passion blinds her. After a few steps, to tell the truth, she would have sat down, or else she would have wanted to go back, or even would have made him carry her. When the future is open to her, she no longer hangs on to the past. When women are concretely called to action, when they identify with the designated aims, they are as strong and brave as men. Note, this is how the attitude of the proletarian women has changed over the century. During the recent strikes in the mines of the North, for example, they showed as much passion and energy as men, demonstrating and fighting side by side. Many of the faults for which they are reproached, mediocrity, meanness, shyness, pettiness, laziness, frivolity, and servility, simply express the fact that the horizon is blocked for them. Woman, it is said, is sensual. She wallows in imminence, but first she was enclosed in it. The slave, imprisoned in the harem, does not feel any morbid passion for rose jelly and perfumed baths. She has to kill time somehow. Inasmuch as the woman is stifling in a dismal gynecium, brothel or bourgeois home, she will also take refuge in comfort and well-being. Moreover, if she avidly pursues sexual pleasure, it is often because she is frustrated, sexually unsatisfied, destined to male brutality, condemned to masculine ugliness. She consoles herself with creamy sauces, heady wines, velvets, the caresses of water, sun, a woman friend, or a young lover. If she appears to man as such a physical being, it is because her condition incites her to attach a great deal of importance to her animality. Carnality does not cry out any more strongly in her than in the male, but she watches out for its slightest signs and amplifies it. Sexual pleasure, like the wrenching of suffering, is the devastating triumph of immediacy. The violence of the instant negates the future and the universe. Outside of the carnal blaze, what is there is nothing. During this brief apotheosis, she is no longer mutilated or frustrated, but once again, she attaches such importance to these triumphs of imminence because it is her only lot. Her frivolity has the same cause as her sordid materialism. She gives importance to little things because she lacks access to big ones. Moreover, the futilities that fill her days are often of great seriousness. She owes her charm and her opportunities to her toilette and beauty. She often seems lazy, indolent, but the occupations that are offered her are as useless as the pure flowing of time. If she is talkative or a scribbler, it is to while away her time. She substitutes words for impossible acts. The fact is that when a woman is engaged in an undertaking worthy of a human being, she knows how to be as active, effective, and silent, as ascetic, as a man. She is accused of being servile. She is always willing, it is said, to lie at her master's feet and to kiss the hand that has beaten her. It is true that she generally lacks real self-regard. Advice to the lovelorn, to betrayed wives, and to abandoned lovers is inspired by a spirit of abject submission. The woman exhausts herself in arrogant scenes and in the end gathers up the crumbs the male is willing to throw her. But what can a woman, for whom the man is both the only means and the only reason for living, do without masculine help? She has no choice but to endure all humiliations. A slave cannot understand the meaning of human dignity. For him, it is enough if he manages to survive. Finally, if she is down to earth, a homebody, simply useful, it is because she has no choice but to devote her existence to preparing food and cleaning diapers. She cannot draw the meaning of grandeur from this. She must ensure the monotonous repetition of life in its contingence and facticity. It is natural for her to repeat herself, to begin again, without ever inventing. To feel that time seems to be going around in circles without going anywhere. She is busy without ever doing anything. So she is alienated in what she has. This dependence on things, a consequence of the dependence in which she is held by men, explains her cautious management, her avarice. Her life is not directed toward goals. She is absorbed in producing or maintaining things that are never more than means, food, clothes, lodging. These are inessential intermediaries between animal life and free existence. The only value that is attached to inessential means is usefulness. The housewife lives at the level of utility, and she takes credit for herself only when she is useful to her family. But no existent is able to satisfy itself with an inessential role. He quickly makes ends out of means, as can be observed in politicians, among others, and in his eyes, the value of the means becomes an absolute value. Thus, utility reigns higher than truth, beauty, and freedom in the housewife's heaven, and this is the point of view from which she envisages the whole universe, and this is why she adopts the Aristotelian morality of the golden mean, of mediocrity. How could one find daring, ardor, detachment, and grandeur in her? These qualities appear only where a freedom throws itself across an open future, emerging beyond any given. A woman is shut up in a kitchen or a boudoir, and one is surprised her horizon is limited. Her wings are cut, and then she is blamed for not knowing how to fly. Let a future be open to her, and she will no longer be obliged to settle in the present. The same foolishness is seen when, closed up in the limits of herself or her home, she is criticized for her narcissism and egotism with their corollaries, vanity, touchiness, meanness, and so forth. all possibility of concrete communication with others is removed from her. In her experience, she does not recognize either the appeal or the advantages of solidarity, since, separated, she is entirely devoted to her own family. She cannot be expected, therefore, to go beyond herself toward the general interest. She obstinately confines herself in the only familiar area where she has the power to grasp things, and where she finds a precarious sovereignty. Although she might close the doors and cover the windows, the woman does not find absolute security in her home. This masculine universe that she respects from afar without daring to venture into it involves her. And because she is unable to grasp it through technology, sound logic, or coherent knowledge, she feels like a child and a primitive surrounded with dangerous mysteries. She projects her magic conception of reality. The flow of things seems inevitable to her, and yet anything can happen. She has difficulty differentiating the possible and the impossible. She is ready to believe anyone. She welcomes and spreads rumors. She sets off panics. Even in calm periods, she lives in worry. At night, half asleep, the inert body is frightened by the nightmare images reality acquires. So for the woman condemned to passivity, the opaque future is haunted by phantoms of war, revolution, famine, and misery. Not being able to act, she worries. When her husband and son embark on a job, when they are passionately involved in an event, they take their own risks. Their projects and the orders they follow show them a sure way, even in darkness. But the woman struggles in the blurry night. She worries because she does not do anything. In imagination, all possibilities are equally real. The train may derail. The operation may be unsuccessful. The affair may fail. What she vainly tries to ward off in her long, despondent ruminations is the specter of her own powerlessness. Worry expresses her mistrust of the given world. If it seems threatening, ready to sink into obscure catastrophes, it is because she does not feel happy in it. Most often, she is not resigned to being resigned. She knows what she is going through. She goes through it in spite of herself. She is woman without being asked. She does not dare revolt. She submits against her will. Her attitude is a constant recrimination. Everyone who receives women's confidences, doctors, priests, social workers, knows that complaint is the commonest mode of expression. Together, women friends groan individually about their own ills and altogether about the injustice of their lot, the world, and men in general. A free individual takes the blame for his failures on himself. He takes responsibility for them. But what happens to the woman comes from others. It is others who are responsible for her misfortune. Her furious despair rejects all remedies. Suggesting solutions to a woman determined to complain does not help. No solution seems acceptable. She wants to live her situation exactly as she lives it, in impotent anger. If a change is suggested to her, she throws her arms up. That's all I need. She knows that her malaise is deeper than the pretext she gives for it, and that one expedient is not enough to get rid of it. She takes it out on the whole world because it was put together without her and against her. Since adolescence, since childhood, she has protested against her condition. She was promised compensations. She was assured that if she abdicated her opportunities into the hands of the man, they would be returned to her 100-fold. And she considers herself duped. She accuses the whole masculine universe. Resentment is the other side of dependence. When one gives everything, one never receives enough in return. But she also needs to respect the male universe. If she contested it entirely, she would feel in danger and without a roof over her head. She adopts the Manichaean attitude also suggested to her by her experience as a housewife. The individual who acts accepts responsibility for good and evil just like the others. He knows that it is up to him to define ends, to see that they triumph. In action, he experiences the ambiguity of all solutions, justice and injustice, gains and losses, are inextricably intermingled. But whoever is passive puts himself on the sidelines and refuses to pose, even in thought, ethical problems. Good must be realized, and if it is not, there is wrongdoing for which the guilty must be punished. Like the child, the woman imagines good and evil in simple storybook images. Manichaeism reassures the mind by eliminating the anguish of choice, deciding between one scourge and a lesser one, between a benefit today and a greater benefit tomorrow, having to define by oneself what is defeat and what is victory. This means taking terrible risks. For the Manichaean, the wheat is clearly distinguishable from the chaff, and the chaff has to be eliminated. Dust condemns itself, and cleanliness is the absolute absence of filth. Cleaning means getting rid of waste and mud. Thus the woman thinks that everything is the Jews' fault, or the Masons, or the Bolsheviks, or the government's. She is always against someone or something. Women were even more violently anti-Dreyfusard than men. They do not always know what the evil principle is, but what they expect from a good government is that it get rid of it as one gets rid of dust from the house. For fervent Gaullists, de Gaulle is the king sweeper. They imagine him, dust mops and rags in hand, scrubbing and polishing to make a clean France. But these hopes are always placed in an uncertain future. Meanwhile, evil continues to eat away at good. And as woman does not have Jews, Masons, and Bolsheviks to hand, she seeks someone against whom she can rise up concretely. The husband is the perfect victim. He embodies the masculine universe. It is through him that the male society took the woman in hand and duped her. He bears the weight of the world, and if things go wrong, it is his fault. When he comes home in the evening, she complains to him about the children, the suppliers, the housework, the cost of living, her rheumatism, and the weather. And she wants him to feel guilty. She often harbors specific complaints about him, but he is particularly guilty of being a man. He might well have illnesses and problems, too. It just isn't the same thing. He is privy to a privilege she constantly resents as an injustice. It is noteworthy that the hostility she feels for the husband or the lover binds her to him instead of moving her away from him. A man who begins to detest wife or mistress tries to get away from her, but she wants to have the man she hates nearby to make him pay. Choosing to recriminate is choosing not to get rid of one's misfortunes, but to wallow in them. Her supreme consolation is to set herself up as martyr. Life and men have conquered her. She will make a victory of this very defeat. Thus, as she did in childhood, she quickly gives way to the frenzy of tears and scenes. It is surely because her life takes place against a background of powerless revolt that the woman cries so easily. She undoubtedly has less physiological control of her nervous and sympathetic systems than the man. Her education taught her to let herself go. Orders and instruction play a great role here since, although Diderot and Benjamin Constant shed rivers of tears, men stopped crying when custom forbade it for them. But the woman is still inclined to be defeatist vis-à-vis the world because she has never frankly assumed it. The man accepts the world. Even misfortune will not change his attitude. He will cope with it. He will not let it get him down. While a little setback is enough for the woman to rediscover the universe's hostility and the injustice of her lot, so she throws herself into her safest refuge, herself. This moist trace on her cheeks, this burning in her eyes, are the tangible presence of her suffering soul. Gentle on one's skin, barely salty on one's tongue, tears are also a tender and bitter caress. The face burns under a stream of mild water. Tears are both complaint and consolation, fever and soothing coolness. They are also a supreme alibi. Sudden as a storm, coming out in fits, a cyclone, shower, deluge, they metamorphose the woman into a complaining fountain. a stormy sky. Her eyes can no longer see. Mist blurs them. They are no longer even a gaze. They melt in rain. Blinded, the woman returns to the passivity of natural things. She must be vanquished. She is lost in her defeat. She sinks. She drowns. She escapes man who contemplates her, powerless as if before a cataract. He judges this way of behaving as unfair, but she thinks that the battle has been unfair from the beginning because no effective weapon has been put into her hands. She resorts once again to magical conjuration, and the fact that these sobs exasperate the male provides her with one more reason to indulge herself in them. If tears are not sufficient to express her revolt, she will carry on in such incoherent violence that it will disconcert the man even more. In some circles, the man might strike his wife with actual blows. In others, because he is the stronger and his fist an effective instrument, he will forego all violence. But the woman, like the child, indulges in symbolic outbursts. She might throw herself on the man, scratch him. These are only gestures. But above all, through nervous fits in her body, she attempts to express the refusals she cannot carry out concretely. It is not only for physiological reasons that she is subject to convulsive manifestations. A convulsion is an interiorization of an energy that, thrown into the world, fails to grasp any object. It is a useless expenditure of all the powers of negation caused by the situation. The mother rarely has crying fits in front of her young children because she can beat or punish them. It is in front of her older son, her husband, or her lover, on whom she has no hold, that the woman gives vent to furious hopelessness. Sophia Tolstoy's hysterical scenes are significant. It is true that she made the big mistake of never trying to understand her husband, and in her diary, she does not seem generous, sensitive, or sincere. She is far from coming across as an endearing person. But whether she was right or wrong does not change the horror of her situation at all. She never did anything in her whole life but submit to the conjugal embraces, pregnancies, solitude, and mode of life that her husband imposed on her while receiving constant recriminations. When new decisions of Tolstoy's worsened the conflict, she found herself weaponless against the enemy's will, which she rejected with all her powerless will. She threw herself into rejection scenes, fake suicides, false escapes, false illnesses, unpleasant to her family and friends, exhausting for herself. It is hard to see any other solution available to her, since she had no positive reason to silence her feelings of revolt and no effective way of expressing them. There is only one solution available to the woman when rejection runs its course: suicide. But it would seem that she resorts to it less than the man. The statistics are very ambiguous. If one considers successful suicides, there are many more men than women who put an end to their lives, but suicide attempts are more frequent in women. Note, see Aldvox, The Causes of Suicide. This may be because they settle more often for play acting. They play at suicide more often than man, but they want it more rarely. It is also in part because such brutal means are repugnant to them. They almost never use knives or firearms. They drown themselves more readily, like Ophelia, showing woman's affinity for water, passive and full of darkness, where it seems that life might be able to dissolve passively. On the whole, this is the ambiguity I already mentioned. The woman does not sincerely seek to take leave of what she detests. She plays at rupture, but in the end remains with the man who makes her suffer. She pretends to leave the life that mistreats her, but it is relatively rare for her to kill herself. She does not favor definitive solutions. She protests against man, against life, against her condition, but she does not escape from it. There is much feminine behavior that has to be interpreted as protest. We have seen that the woman often cheats on her husband by defiance and not for pleasure. She will be absent-minded and a spendthrift on purpose because he is methodical and careful. Misogynists who accuse woman of always being late think she lacks the sense of exactitude. In truth, we have seen how docilely she adapts to the demands of time. Being late is deliberate. Some flirtatious women think that this is the way to excite the desire of the man, who will thus attach more importance to their presence. But above all, in keeping a man waiting for a few minutes, the woman protests against this long wait that is her own life. In one sense, her whole existence is a waiting, since she is enclosed in the limbo of imminence and contingency, and her justification is always in someone else's hands. She is waiting for a tribute, men's approval. She is waiting for love. She is waiting for gratitude and her husband's or lover's praise. She expects to gain from them her reasons to exist, her worth, and her very being. She awaits her subsistence from them, whether she has her own checkbook or receives the money her husband allocates to her every week or month. He has to have been paid, obtained the raise for her to pay the grocer, or buy a new dress. She awaits men's presence. Her economic dependence puts her at their disposal. She is only one element of masculine life, whereas the man is her whole life. The husband has occupations outside the home. The woman endures his absence every day. It is the lover, even if passionate, who decides on the separation and meetings according to his obligations. In bed, she awaits the male's desire. She awaits, sometimes anxiously, her own pleasure. The only thing she can do is to be late for the date the lover set up, or not to be ready at the time the husband fixed. This is the way she asserts the importance of her own occupations. She claims her independence. She becomes the essential subject for a moment while the other passively submits to her will. But this is meager revenge. No matter how determined she might be to make men stew, she will never compensate for the infinite hours she has spent being subjected to and watching out and hoping for the male's goodwill. In general, while more or less acknowledging men's supremacy and accepting their authority, worshiping their idols, she will contest their reign tooth and nail, hence the famous contrariness for which she is so often criticized. As she does not possess an autonomous domain, she cannot put forward truths or positive values different from those that males assert. She can only negate them. Her negation is more or less systematic, depending on her particular balance of respect and resentment. But the fact is, she knows all the fault lines of the masculine system, and she hastens to denounce them. Women do not have a hold on the world of men, because their experience does not teach them to deal with logic and technology. Conversely, the power of male instruments disappears at the borders of the feminine domain. There is a whole region of human experience that the male deliberately chooses to ignore because he fails to think it. This experience, the woman lives it. The engineer, so precise when making his plans, behaves like a demigod at home. One word, and his meal is served, his shirts starched, his children silenced. Procreating is an act that is as quick as Moses's magic rod. He sees nothing surprising in these miracles. The notion of miracle differs from the idea of magic. From within a rationally determined world, a miracle posits the radical discontinuity of an event without cause, against which any thinking shatters. Whereas magic phenomena are united by secret forces of which a docile consciousness can embrace the continuous becoming, without understanding it. The newborn is miraculous for the demigod father, magic for the mother who has undergone the ripening in her womb. Man's experience is intelligible but full of holes. That of the wife is, in its own limits, obscure but complete. This opacity weighs her down. The male is light in his relations with her. He has the lightness of dictators, generals, judges, bureaucrats, codes, and abstract principles. This is undoubtedly what this housewife meant when, shrugging her shoulders, she murmured, "Men, they don't think." Women also say, "Men, they don't know. They don't know life." As a contrast to the myth of the praying mantis, they juxtapose the symbol of the frivolous and importunate bumblebee. It is understandable why, from this perspective, woman objects to masculine logic. Not only does it have no bearing on her experience, but she also knows that in men's hands, reason becomes an insidious form of violence. Their peremptory affirmations are intended to mystify her. They want to confine her in a dilemma. Either you agree or you don't. She has to agree in the name of the whole system of accepted principles. In refusing to agree, she rejects the whole system. She cannot allow herself such a dramatic move. She does not have the means to create another society. Yet she does not agree with this one. Halfway between revolt and slavery, she unwillingly resigns herself to masculine authority. He continuously uses force to make her shoulder the consequences of her reluctant submission. He pursues the chimera of a freely enslaved companion. He wants her to yield to him as yielding to the proof of a theorem. But she knows he himself has chosen the postulates on which his vigorous deductions are hung. As long as she avoids questioning them, he will easily silence her. Nevertheless, he will not convince her, because she senses their arbitrariness. Thus will he accuse her, with stubborn irritation, of being illogical. She refuses to play the game because she knows the dice are loaded. The woman does not positively think that the truth is other than what men claim. Rather, she holds that there is no truth. It is not only life's becoming that makes her suspicious of the principle of identity, nor the magic phenomena surrounding her that ruin the notion of causality. It is at the heart of the masculine world itself. It is in her as belonging to this world that she grasps the ambiguity of all principles, of all values, of all that exists. She knows that when it comes to her, masculine morality is a vast mystification. The man pompously drums his code of virtue and honor into her. But secretly, he invites her to disobey it. He even counts on this disobedience. The whole lovely facade he hides behind would collapse without it. The man readily uses the pretext of the Hegelian idea that the male citizen acquires his ethical dignity by transcending himself toward the universal. As a singular individual, he has the right to desire and pleasure. His relations with woman thus lie in a contingent region where morality no longer applies, where conduct is inconsequential. His relations with other men are based on certain values. He is a freedom confronting other freedoms according to laws universally recognized by all. But with woman, she was invented for this reason. He ceases to assume his existence. He abandons himself to the mirage of the in itself. He situates himself on an inauthentic plane. He is tyrannical, sadistic, violent or puerile, masochistic or querulous. He tries to satisfy his obsessions, his manias. He relaxes, he lets go in the name of rights he has acquired in his public life. His wife is often surprised, like Thérèse Descayrou, by the contrast between the lofty tone of his remarks, of his public conduct, and his patient inventions in the dark. Note, Mauriac, Thérèse Descayrou, translation. He preaches population growth, but he is clever at not having more children than are convenient for him. He praises chaste and faithful wives, but he invites his neighbor's wife to commit adultery. We have seen the hypocrisy of men decreeing abortion to be criminal when every year in France a million women are put by men into the situation where they have to abort. Very often the husband or lover imposes this solution on them, and often these men tacitly assume that it will be used if necessary. They openly count on the woman to consent to making herself guilty of a crime. Her immorality is necessary for the harmony of moral society, respected by men. The most flagrant example of this duplicity is man's attitude to prostitution. It is his demand that creates the offer. I have spoken of the disgusted skepticism with which prostitutes view respectable gentlemen who condemn vice in general, but show great indulgence for their personal foibles. They consider girls who make a living with their bodies perverse and debauched, and not the men who use them. An anecdote illustrates this state of mind. At the end of the last century, the police discovered two little girls of 12 or 13 in a bordello. A trial was held where they testified. They spoke of their clients, who were important gentlemen. One of them opened her mouth to give a name. The judge abruptly stopped her. "Do not sully the name of an honest man." A gentleman, decorated with the Legion of Honor, remains an honest man while deflowering a little girl. He has his weaknesses, but who does not? However, the little girl who has no access to the ethical region of the universal, who is neither judge, nor general, nor a great French man, nothing but a little girl, gambles her moral value in the contingent region of sexuality. She is perverted, corrupted, depraved, and good only for the reformatory. In many cases, the man can commit acts with woman's complicity that degrade her without tarnishing his lofty image. She does not understand these subtleties very well. What she does understand is that the man's actions do not conform to the principles he professes and that he asks her to disobey them. He does not want what he says he wants. She therefore does not give him what she pretends to give him. She will be a chaste and faithful wife, and in secret, she will give in to her desires. She will be an admirable mother, but she will carefully practice birth control, and she will have an abortion if she must. Officially, the man renounces her. Those are the rules of the game. But he is clandestinely grateful to one for her easy virtue, to another for her sterility. The woman has the role of those secret agents who are left to the firing squad if they are caught, and who are covered with rewards if they succeed. It is for her to shoulder all of male's immorality. It is not only the prostitute, it is all the women who serve as the gutter to the luminous and clean palaces where respectable people live. When one speaks to these women of dignity, honor, loyalty, and all the lofty virile virtues, one should not be surprised if they refuse to go along. They particularly snigger when virtuous males reproach them for being calculating, actresses, liars. They know well that no other way